You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. The program is Praxis. That means it's 4 p.m. on a Saturday. Before I dive into the show today, I will let you know that Praxis receives support from Puffin Glass Studios, a purveyor of functional glass art and smoking accessories, 8 locations in the state of Washington. Information available at 509-328-0661 and online at puffinglassstudios.com. And as I said, you're listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today, continuing a month of education-themed shows that that I've been sharing with you through November. Last week's show was so great, and I am very dismayed to share with you some bad news. It was a higher ed roundtable that I hosted with 3 very recent college grads of different backgrounds, different majors, different degrees, different institutions, different lifestyles, and it was very interesting. And my recording was ruined through some glitch in equipment, and I do not have that podcast. So if you've been looking for the podcast, I'm really sorry about that. But the good news is everyone who was on it has agreed to come in and record a second hour. And we will very likely end up with more than the full hour, or more like 50 minutes that you get on the podcast. And there will also be additional guests in the studio. So there's a silver lining that I've been able to embrace after after a few days of dealing with that. So, on that note, today's show is going to be a continuation of that. We're going to talk a little bit about secondary school, about compulsory education in the U.S., which is a topic I've talked about a lot, but there's so much going on right now that I'm going to come back to it. We're going to talk about just kind of a state of the union type, what's going on right now with primary and secondary school, mostly secondary, mostly high school, because that's where a lot of, I guess, activists are born. Students become a little more disgruntled. Parents are more involved at that point because they're worried about college and things like this. And teachers have also been turning up the heat on certain policies. So that's what we're going to talk about. Do a check-in. How's it going? What does it look like? What are some alternatives? Especially that's a big focus that I want to have. And how are students organizing to get some of those alternatives? So, and this is an ongoing thread in the show, and it's something I return to again and again because the education system is something that almost all of us have in common. It's changed a lot, but within a couple generations, we pretty much all have that in common. It's a big tool for socializing people, for better or for worse, and it's how we transmit information to younger generations. Mass media and public education are those things. And I and many others would argue that right now it's not doing a good job. We're not really getting the kind of return that we want if we want a free society, if we want a more positive culture, if we want informed people. So how can we change that? What are the factors that drive it being kind of inexcusably bad in many ways? What's good about it and how can we build that and all the rest? So yeah, I'm going to get all this queued up for you and start off with a little short talk from Alan Watts that'll set the tone for this show. So enjoy, and I will queue up all the goodies that I have laid out for the show today. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll be right back.
In music, one doesn't make the end of a composition the point of the composition. If that were so, the best conductors would be those who played fastest. And there would be composers who wrote only finales. People go to concert just to hear one crashing chord, because that's the end. but we don't see that as something brought by our education into our everyday conduct. We've got a system of schooling which gives a completely different impression. It's all graded. And what we do is we put the child into the corridor of this grade system with a kind of, come on, kitty, kitty, kitty. And yeah, you go to kindergarten, you know. And that's a great thing because when you finish that, you'll get into first grade. And then, come on, first grade leads to second grade and so on. And then you get out of grade school, you go to high school, and it's revving up. The thing is coming. Then you're going to go to college. And by Jove, then you get into graduate school. And when you're through with graduate school, you go out to join the world. And then you get into some racket where you're selling insurance. And they've got that quota to make. And you're going to make that. And all the time, this thing is coming. It's coming. It's coming. That great thing, the success you're working for. Then when you wake up one day about 40 years old, you say, my God, I've arrived. I'm there. And you don't feel very different from what you always felt. And there's a slight letdown because you feel there's a hoax. And there was a hoax. A dreadful hoax. They made you miss everything. We thought of life by analogy with a journey, with a pilgrimage, which had a serious purpose at the end. And the thing was to get to that end. Success or whatever it is, or maybe heaven after you're dead. But we missed the point the whole way along. It was a musical thing, and you were supposed to sing or to dance while the music was being played.
So there's a little tone setting for you from Alan Watts talking about education and kind of this whole cultural idea that we have here in what we can vaguely call the West, but definitely kind of centered here in the U.S. So let's continue. Some of what we'll talk about at the beginning here is just what it looks like in the U.S. right now. Mostly, the reason I have the specific thing pulled up, we're going to mostly talk about public school today. The reason being that 88% of school-age kids are in public school in the U.S. 9% attend private schools, which are a whole other matter, and about 3% are homeschooled. And homeschooling is also something really fascinating that I'd like to bring some parents in and some students in sometime to talk about. I think it's shifting away from being a more religiously motivated option to being an otherwise motivated option, just wanting to get out of the school system for various reasons that we'll be discussing today. So let's see, where was the other thing I was looking for? Over 85% of the adult population has completed high school in the U.S. And the country has a reading literacy rate of 99% of the population. And in 2008, there was a 77% graduation rate from high school. So that's all pretty much holds true in Washington State, where we are right now. But I suppose you could be listening to the podcast anywhere around. So I was thinking, I was making a list about what characterizes the high school experience in the U.S. today. I'm fairly fresh out of that system, less than a decade, so I have a decent perspective on it myself. And I think testing is really the main thing that has separated my generation and the generation currently in secondary school from that of our parents and many parents, the ones who have the leisure time to be highly involved in school or just the level of passion to be highly involved in their student schooling, are upset about it in a lot of cases. So, I found a very interesting film, which I have not watched all of, but will, by Anchor Singh. It's called Listen, and it's a student-produced film about testing culture in America's schools. And this is an interview with him that I'm going to share with you that is on, oh dear, that's on the World Socialist website, wsws.org. Give me 1 second to pull that up. Sorry about that. I'm also struggling with some headphone cords here. I have a lot of technical difficulty today. So let's just dive into this. Listen, the film, and this is by Phyllis Scherer at World Socialist website. Listen, the film is a documentary written, produced, filmed, and narrated by 20-year-old filmmaker Ankur Singh from Normal, Illinois. I love that that's the name of a town. It is an honest film presented from the standpoint of students about the terrible cost of the testing regimen in the public schools promoted under Bush's No Child Left Behind and Obama's Race to the Top schemes. Production started in December 2012 when Singh was a freshman in college. Singh produced the film using $2,000 raised through a Kickstarter campaign and his own resources. The film has had 15 viewings at campuses through the country since its release in September 2013. In March, he made the film available free online here to reach a wider audience. The film opens with Bush and No Child Left Behind being signed into law in 2002. Singh was in second grade at the time. He took his first test in fourth grade and in high school signed up for AP, Advanced Placement courses, where he said he was forced to memorize hundreds of pages of text just to spit it back out. Commenting on his attraction to filmmaking at a young age, Singh says the art form requires genuine rigor, problem-solving, creativity, and patience. Seeking an answer as to why similar creativity and intellectual curiosity were being undermined in school in favor of a constant stream of tests, Singh says, I decided to figure out what is going on with our education system. His first stop was in Colorado Springs, Colorado, where he met with students Aubrey and Levi Bishop. Aubrey has sensory integration problems, which, she says, the high-pressure tests only exacerbated. Her family requested relief under the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, but the school essentially told her parents she can walk, talk, read, and write so she can take the test. Singh spoke with Aubrey's brother, Levi Bishop, who has anxiety disorder and Asperger symptoms, and who was punished for not taking the CSAP, Colorado State Assessment Program, for fourth graders. Singh asked Aubrey and Levi's mother how this treatment made her feel. How does it make me feel? Our kids get one chance at a high-quality, equitable education. That's it. It's been ruined, she said. Singh spoke with... Levi, now a teenager, gave his analysis. What the schools don't understand is that they want to standardize everybody. Not everybody can be standardized. Other interviewees include non-English speaker Salvador Bustamante, forced to take standardized tests in his non-native language, and 20-year teaching veteran Robin Kotz, who quit because of federal education policy. Then there's Louise Schmitz, a college math major in Florida, who explained how testing led to her dropping out of high school. In this section of the film, Singh cites a 2011 National Research Council report, which found end-of-grade tests don't improve achievement, but they do increase dropout rates. Her mother, Teresa, describes how Louise did exactly what she would do when she agreed to sign her out of high school. She took her GED exam and enrolled in college. She was enrolled in courses and had an apartment ready when her application for a student loan was refused, so she went to work instead. Teresa, a kindergarten teacher, describes the painful process of forcing standardized testing onto 5- and 6-year-olds, whom she has to sit with one by one and teach how to fill in the bubbles. In the film, Singh engages Gage Park High School students in a working-class neighborhood of Chicago who refused to take an optional standardized test. One student demands, "Why should we give them data? They don't care how teachers feel in the workplace or how students feel, and they don't let teachers decide their own curriculum." The Chicago High School, Singh reports, had its funding cut by $1 million 4 months after the interview. He wrestles with the iniquities. Why is it that in the wealthiest country on earth, the children of the poor get torn up textbooks, don't get field trips, and are still expected to score as high as someone else? Fighting for public funding for public education is in a state of disaster, Singh narrates, adding that schools are being closed, teachers are losing their pensions and being fired, and extracurricular programs are being cut. They don't even have money for toilet paper, he angrily declares as his camera follows two female students, showing how their Chicago school bathroom lacks the most basic necessities. Singh, still looking for answers, asks rhetorically, where is all the money for education going? He points to private testing and publishing companies making handsome profits and expresses outrage that this money is not invested in students instead. He points to a Brookings Institution report that $1.7 billion is spent on tests alone and adds that the real figure is much larger if one takes into account the money paid to those who create, administer, market, and sell the tests. Meanwhile, he points to the irrational use of resources. In Chicago, public schools are closed as the city spent $33 million to build DePaul University, a new basketball stadium. Philadelphia closed 23 schools and then opted to open a $400 million prison instead. In St. Louis, Peabody, the world's largest coal company, received $61 million in tax credits, yet $2 million was taken from the St. Louis School District. While corporate school reformers often point at how poorly U.S. schools do on standardized tests, Singh says they ignore that America is number 2 for child poverty in the developed world. The number one indicator of students' test score is their household income, he says, adding, so the problem clearly isn't lazy teachers, unmotivated students, low standards, not enough math classes, or too long a summer break. The problem is poverty. So it's not a surprise that the majority of schools targeted for closure are in impoverished neighborhoods. Singh's documentary exposes how the educational policies of both big business parties are creating a class-based school system in America. Unlike other films that address the issue of testing, including standardized, to his credit, Singh is not held back by any allegiance to the teachers' unions or the Democratic Party. This makes his film far more honest and allows the victims of this policy to voice their anger and opposition. The film concludes with video clips of mass protests by students in Quebec and Chile and in U.S. cities such as Portland, Oregon, and Chicago. Students hold banners declaring education is not a commodity and denounce school officials for setting up their schools to fail and be closed. At this point, however, Singh cannot find a way forward. He suggests instead that student protests, including campaigns to opt out of testing, can somehow persuade the powers that be to change course. He interviews a participant in the 2012 Quebec student strike, saying, as students all over the world, we have to demand a seat at the table that is permanent. Echoing this sentiment, Singh concludes the film with an angry appeal to students. With education not a priority for both Democrats and Republicans, this is not a problem that can be fixed through a vote. This is a change that has to come from us, and who better to do it than a student? Students on their own cannot overcome the immense economic and political forces that are destroying public education around the world. Such a sentiment, however naive, is nevertheless understandable given the fact that this generation has never seen mass struggles by the working class. But the right to education itself was bound up with such struggles, including the industrial and civil rights battles to end child labor and expand public education to every section of the population, regardless of class background. It's the working class, however, that youth must turn to find the social force capable of breaking the grip of the corporate and financial elite and reorganizing society on the basis of human need, not profit. All of the determination of young people to fight for a future free of poverty, ignorance, and war must be turned into building the leadership necessary to mobilize the working class against the two big business parties and the profit system they defend. So, obviously, we get a socialist conclusion to this review, which I tend to agree with. Again, if you're just joining me, that was long. Phyllis Schur's review of Listen, the film, a film by Ankur Singh, which I'm going to look up and actually watch. I just found this today, so I've not had a chance to read it. But there's a lot tied up there. And if you've been listening to this whole month, if you are a loyal Praxis listener, you heard the show I did 2 weeks ago about childhood trauma and learning and toxic stress. And that, again, ties back to poverty, too. So really, part of the big conclusion of this whole month of studying every part of the ed system, same with higher ed, last week, is that profit needs to go out of the system and that poverty is really the underlying problem for pretty much every student. So, and also for people complain about parental involvement and how involved can you be in a PTA if you're working two or three jobs, if you have strange hours? Is your kid going to be able to go to extracurricular activities if they cost money, if they aren't compatible with your work schedule, et cetera, et cetera? So it's a very real issue, and it sounds like a really interesting movie. I like the approach of having student-led change. I really think that's what's going to work, along with teachers. Hopefully, enough teachers have the wherewithal and the energy left to get some of these changes made. So, this is another piece that's going to actually just bounce right off of that first one. And it's very long, so I'm going to kind of summarize some of it, which is what I should have done with that last article too, because it was long, but it is what it is. So this is just a couple days old. It's in the Atlantic. A lot of this is information that people know, but I think it's important to hear some of the statistics again and just really get it drilled in. And this is also about class and its intersection with race, which hopefully we have a understanding of as a listening audience here. And if not, this is one way you can learn right now about those two intersections. This is in the Atlantic. as I said, it's by Sonali Kohli. It's called Modern Day Segregation in Public Schools, and it's about the phenomenon of tracking, which is basically through testing and through, I guess, baseline student aptitude, preparedness for school when entering school, how students are tracked into advanced, quote-unquote, normal and remedial classes, which that takes a lot of forms across school. But I remember being in school fairly recently and being one of those students who was tracked into upper-level classes, advanced classes. It opened up a lot of doors as far as electives went, as far as experiences that I got to have that my classmates didn't. And really, it was something that was decided by the time I was about 8. You pretty much know what track you're going to be in by that age. And maybe middle school, you get a second chance to, like, you know, bump it up to the next one. But it makes a huge difference when you're told as an 8 or 9 year old, either that you're smarter than most people or that you're dumber than most people. And that's really the way it's framed. Teachers don't use those words, but children have these incredible lie detectors built in. It's part of, I think, kids' strength. They know BS when they see it. And that, you know, it takes a toll on self-esteem. It also builds confidence in people who maybe don't have all of the ability that they think they do, which that happens maybe just as often. And so let's dive into this Sonali Kohli article on The Atlantic before I rant too much about tracking. We'll just let this give us the framework, and I'll bounce in and out of the article as I tend to do. So she says, U.S. Department of Education press release last month had a disorienting retro ring to it. It said, quote, Black students to be afforded equal access to advanced higher level learning opportunities, the announcement proclaimed, 6 decades after the country's Supreme Court determined that segregation in public schools was unconstitutional in the landmark ruling known as Brown versus Board of Education. The press release contained news about a New Jersey school district's decision over the controversial practice known as tracking, designating students for separate educational paths based on their academic performance as teens or younger. The Education Department and advocates have said tracking perpetuates a modern system of segregation that favors white students and keeps students of color, many of them Black, from long-term equal achievement. Now the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights is trying to change the system, one school district at a time. Proponents of tracking and of ability grouping, a milder version that separates students within the same classroom based on ability, says that the practices allow students to learn at their own levels and prevent a difficult situation for teachers, large classes where children with a wide range of different needs and skill levels are mixed together. In many districts, the higher level instruction in gifted and talented or advanced placement classes is what keeps wealthier families from entirely abandoning the public school system. But opponents say the ill effects for the students in the lower skilled classes negate the advantages that the students in the advanced classes gain. Many education researchers have argued that tracking perpetuates class inequality and is partially to blame for the stubborn achievement gap in the U.S. educational system, between white and Asian students on one side and Black and Latino students on the other. One New Jersey parent, Walter Fields, describes watching the effect of tracking firsthand with his own African-American daughter, who was denied entry to an advanced freshman math class. She had the middle school grades and standardized test scores to take the higher level math class, but didn't get the required recommendation from a teacher to take the class. That doesn't sound sketchy at all. That didn't change until Fields and his wife petitioned the principal to allow their daughter to take the higher level class. Fields is part of a complaint that the American Civil Liberties Union and the Civil Rights Project at UCLA filed against the South Orange Maplewood School District, alleging that tracking unfairly holds back African American and Latino students. Now we arrive at the point in 2014 where you can literally walk down a hallway in Columbia High School and look in a classroom and know whether it's an upper-level class or a lower-level class based on the racial composition of the classroom, Fields said. Fields, the editor of the website North Star News, says that tracking is a racial issue, not just one of class. There are plenty of middle-class Black students, like his own daughter, who find themselves tracked into lower-level classes. South Orange Maplewood does have a racial disparity issue. In its upper-level classes, its Board of Education President Beth Dougherty acknowledged in an interview with Quartz. The diverse district, with within commutable distance to New York City, has a well-educated and upper-middle-class population, including professors, lawyers, and journalists, she says. But about a fourth of the high school also receives free and reduced lunch, pointing to its socioeconomic diversity. The district had 6,622 students, 38% of them Black and 49% white as of June 2013. But at every level where students are tracked, Black students were underrepresented in higher-level classes. There's some graphs about that. And this is, it's something that I would love to see numbers pulled on for Lewis and Clark High School, where I went, North Central High School, Rogers High School, and to see what the racial disparity is like, because I know on a gut level, having attended LC, I know who was in advanced classes with me and who wasn't. And it was largely, it's a more visible class divide here in Spokane because of the relative homogeny of our racial mixture being largely white. But LC is also a racially diverse school, and the advanced classes I was in were significantly less racially diverse and non-white than the fundamentally, you know, the mixed classes that I was in that were electives, or that were, you know, compulsory non-tracked classes like PE and the rest. So yeah, that's part of where class and race intersect in schools. I am going to leave that one there because I feel like I've covered the bulk of what I wanted to cover in it. And so a lot of things have been happening lately that we're having some interesting national dialogues right now, I feel. And race is one of them. It's a big one with Ferguson, the ongoing protests in Ferguson that we've covered here, ongoing police brutality against Black men and women, and the reaction of, to generalize broadly, white people, including, you know, well-educated white people, has really illuminated, I think, how skewed a lot of people's take is on history, how incomplete people's understanding can be of the reality for people living in this country. What does that have to do with what I'm talking about right now? Well, it has to do with curriculum, which is, you know, what makes up what we're learning. And sorry, I started reading something and lost what I was saying, but now I'm back. And there has been a very interesting, I don't know if people have been following this story, but there, Texas is the heart of the textbook industry, which is a large industry. Houghton Mifflin and the rest, Scholastic, making, you know, huge amounts of money in building curriculum, selling textbooks, and providing the content of public schooling in America is done by private companies. So in theory, there are federal standards for what the content is, but we can read a little bit about how this happened and what it means to have a pro-American history text. This is talking about an advanced placement class, and which is something I was involved in that's kind of an alternative within the system in certain ways. You get college credit for taking the tests that follow, the standardized test that follows this advanced class. It's a college equivalent class. So basically you can show up at college having already completed a prerequisite, you know, 101, 100 level history, English, art history, and the rest. I took a lot of these, and it's a mixed bag of what the experience was. But when I'm referencing AP in this article, it refers to advanced placement, which are those classes. And this specifically talks about Native Americans' treatment in these history books. And it's written by Shannon Speed, who's a Chickasaw tribal citizen, and she's the director of Native American and Indigenous Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. And this is on Huffington Post. She says pro-American history textbooks hurt Native Americans. And here's what she says. You can apply a lot of her statements here about Native Americans. You can also apply them to Black Americans and the ignorance of history there, the denial of history there. You could apply it to basically any immigrant group more in the last 100 years. You can apply it to women in a lot of ways. You can apply it to political theories outside of capitalism, which are also disparaged as un-American, and many more. So let's hear what she has to say specifically about Native American history and culture, though. She says, "I teach Native American studies, and virtually none of my university students has had any education whatsoever in the history of this country's treatment of the 10 million or so people who lived here before Europeans arrived. They generally believe that the continent was more or less wide open, and that the few people who were here aided the pilgrims with a harvest fest, and then, after a few skirmishes with settlers, complied with their destiny as the vanishing Indian." The Texas State Board of Education wants to reinforce this knowledge gap, forcing Texas high schoolers to learn a sanitized version of U.S. history in the name of being, quote, pro-American. The Texas Board recently voted to allow state-defined curriculum for the Advanced Placement History exam to trump that of the federally defined curriculum on which the exam will be based in order to sidestep aspects of U.S. history they find distasteful. The board is expected to take a final vote on textbook approval on Friday. The Texas Board took this measure even though it is certain to disadvantage Texas high school students on the AP test. They feel the purpose of teaching history, as one school board member recently stated, is to, quote, teach students to be proud American citizens. But as a professor at Texas's flagship university, I have found these omissions to have the opposite effect. My students are usually quite surprised to find that they have been provided a whitewashed version of history. They are often outraged. They feel lied to. Omission of the truth is, in fact, a form of lying. I would offer that the purpose of teaching history in schools is to create critical thinkers capable of meaningful participation in a democratic society. Not surprisingly, with attitudes like those exhibited by their stance on history, Texas is often failing to do that. I am regularly alarmed at my first-year students' lack of critical thinking ability. These are bright students. They wouldn't be at UT if they weren't. They simply haven't been taught to think critically because their education favored memorization and successful performance on standardized tests. This is exactly the problem the overhaul of AP US History Test and related curriculum was designed to overcome. But the board found the new curriculum to be anti-American because it includes negative aspects, quote, of US history. Pat Hardy, another conservative school board member, said, quote, "To me, there was a negativity to the standards, and very few positives about America were found." Oh, I just want to bask in the glow of that sentence for a second. You mean a critical reading of history shows that there's not a lot of positives about the founding of America? Shocking. Continuing with the article, while the school board claims the problem is anti-American bias, the material in question is not a matter of interpretation. The United States expanded by systemically eliminating Native Americans from under official policies and acts of Congress with names like removal, reorganization, termination, and relocation. Millions died, and many millions of acres of their lands were taken from them to serve the advancing settlers. Ideologies of white racial superiority were widespread from colony through the early 20th century and were regularly and openly offered as the justification for these harms as necessary to the civilizing mission. Things that actually happened being taught in history class. Radical in Texas and exported to elsewhere, apparently. She says, "These are historical facts. These events and dynamics shaped our country, and they should be taught to our students. Providing our students with a strictly positive version of U.S. history does not produce proud Americans, nor does teaching the difficult truth of our country's history necessarily produce citizens that are not patriotic." So that is Shannon Speed on Huffington Post talking about this idea of pro-American history. I find it very interesting, as I said, as a graduate of this specific program in question, AP US History, which is a federal curriculum. I remember, you know, as you might imagine, I was starting, you know, at that time to push the edges of what's going on and what the real story is. Hadn't was just getting introduced to people like Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky and hearing this entirely different version of events than what I had heard. And my recollection of the curriculum as it already existed then was that it was rather pro-American. You know, it's neoliberal in its outlook. It's, you know, it's showing, you know, globalization as a force for good and neoliberal economic policies as being a, you know, a hand up, that progress has always been led by America and that we are the heirs to the, you know, wonders of capitalism. That was definitely in the book. It was very interesting. I remember the book ended, the edition we were using in 2008 was probably a 2002 edition, 2003. So it ends with the first invasion of Iraq, which is very interesting. And I'd love to see what the new editions come up with for the last 10 years. So this idea that that curriculum was not pro-American enough when someone like me would already find it biased is fascinating. And as she points out, just because the quote-unquote negative aspects of history, people don't want to talk about them, doesn't mean they're not true. And maybe that's how we change the racism built into our systems, the class inequality that's built by the systems that we perpetuate, and all of that. So this is not what I wanted. I wanted another article that's about, so that curriculum from Texas, those standards, there's an attempt made to expand them to other states because of Texas's role in textbook design, curricular content, and all of that. And here are how few students feel about that. Here is the reaction of some students. This is on Socialist Alternative. Also, the socialists are really paying attention to this issue, and many of the great sources that I found for today's show are from different socialist groups. So this is on socialistalternative.org. It's by Elliot Jensen, and it takes place in Colorado. This is a shorter piece, but it's just from earlier this month. This is something that's going on right now. It's a developing story, and these students are kind of ramping it up in Colorado right now. He says, a wave of student walkouts and teacher protests pushed back attempts to literally rewrite history in Jefferson County. Several suburban cities just west of Denver, Colorado, saw a wave of protest against the efforts of Jefferson County School Board to censor AP U.S. history classes. Conservative members of the county school board urged a review of the curriculum, declaring, quote, materials should promote citizenship, patriotism, essentials and benefits of the free enterprise system, there it is, respect for authority, and respect for individual rights. Materials should not encourage or condone civil disorder, social strife, or disregard of the law, end quote. This came after attacks on the present curriculum came from the Texas State Board of Education as well as the Republican National Committee, who denounced it as revisionist and anti-American. Is this Orwellian enough for you guys out there? I hope you're enjoying it as much as I am. Wow, yeah. Respect for authority, respect for individual rights. How could you study U.S. history? This is a genuine question, and if you want to call and tell me what your answer is, feel free. How can you study U.S. history without studying civil disorder, social strife, and disregard of the law? Pretty much everyone, you know, these same Republicans probably during Black History Month will trot out something about the civil rights movement. I mean, any time that meaningful social change has happened in any increment in this country, it has come through disregard for the current laws. There has been social strife leading up to it. And yeah, civil disorder is how people have broken down some of the oppression of these systems that are to be not questioned, but rather enshrined, so that students can feel patriotic about the essentials and benefits of the free enterprise system, even as it crumbles around them and gives them very little to look forward to in terms of a livelihood. So interesting stuff. Continuing with Elliot Jensen's piece here. These moves reflect growing fear from big business's allies over the threat of radical movements emerging among young Americans. And as the protest movement showed, they're completely right to be scared. This attempt spectacularly backfired as students and teachers fought back. Awareness and outrage spread after hundreds of the students themselves initiated walkouts at several high schools across the country. This inspired a wave of action by many teachers, calling in sick en masse, forcing two high schools to close. Sensing the strength and unity of public opposition, and likely taken off guard by the swiftness of the movement, the school board quickly abandoned the most disturbing language of the measure. This is yet another illustration of the power of ordinary people to sway the outcomes if we organize and act boldly. The fight is not over, however, as the school board decided on a compromise, which would continue with their plan to review the curriculum, though now with the inclusion of some teachers, students, and board-appointed community members on the review committee. While these events in Colorado have brought the public education system back into the spotlight, they represent just the latest episode of a determined and vicious siege that arrived with the rise of neoliberalism in the 1970s. For example, corporate lobbies like ALEC and the Heartland Institute are currently fighting tooth and nail to ensure that K-12 science classes teach balanced climate science, meaning that actual scientific consensus is balanced by giving equal credence to climate change denial. Whew. Allow me to have a little rage breath there. Oh, at universities, student tuitions are forced to bear greater and greater portions of the financial burden as federal and state funding dries up, making higher education increasingly unaffordable for many Americans. Education is increasingly structured around meeting the needs of big business rather than what students need to reach their full potential. But the passionate spirit of resistance in Jefferson County is not isolated either. This type of uprising in defense of education is also on the rise, as demonstrated by the Chicago Teachers Union, massive strikes, and Seattle teachers' boycott of standardized tests in 2012, just to give two examples. History, if we are able to study it, shows us again and again that when working people take the task upon ourselves to come together in unity and defiance, we can change our lives for a better future. But if the school boards have their way, we won't learn about that part of history. Things just magically happen in that world, I guess. If there's no civil disorder or struggle to change things. Very interesting. Also in Colorado, let's find this. Also in Colorado, not over that specific curricular insanity, standardized testing in general is also heating up there. It's really good to see these students kind of taking things into their own hands. We talked a lot during the roundtable last week on the show about stereotypes about this generation that spans from high school students now through my generation to people about 30. The millennials, you'll hear about them a lot. It's a buzzy topic. There's a huge stereotype about this generation that are apathetic and lazy, and I think that an interesting interpretation of that is perhaps that there's fewer of us who have any desire to participate in the systems that exist, because they don't really have a whole lot to offer at this point. You know, there's not a lot to look forward to as we continue this project of expansion and profit over all else and inequality and racism. We don't see a lot of value in that project, I think. And as the generations keeping these systems in power, the individuals keeping these systems rolling, double down and don't cede control to this emerging generation, I think withdrawal is going to be a big part of what happens as we hopefully build a more egalitarian new society in the shell of the old. And here's some information about that. This is from Colorado Public Radio, and it's by Jenny Brunden. This is also from just last week. She says, more than 5,000 Colorado 12th graders have refused to take the new state-mandated science and social studies tests as student anxiety about overtesting grows. Hundreds of high school students in Boulder staged a mass walkout Thursday and Friday, refusing to take their 12th grade social studies and science tests. Fairview High School students say they want to send a clear message that when it comes to testing, enough is enough. The new state tests, the Colorado Measures of Academic Success, or CMAS, are supposed to measure how much students have learned in science and social studies since ninth grade. It's the first time the tests are being given to upperclassmen in high school, as they say the new exams won't impact their future. A group of students released this video late last week outlining their complaints. Let's see if it'll load fast enough. Let's listen to it. Actually, I haven't watched this yet, so let's check it out together.
Hi. If you're watching this, you've probably heard about the new CMAS testing that Colorado has implemented for high school seniors. The following is a brief overview of what CMAS is, why we oppose it, and the actions we are taking at this time.
In accordance with the No Child Left Behind Act, a federal law passed in 2002, every state must assess their students' proficiency in math, writing, reading, and science with the standardized testings. For us, this was CSAP, then TCAP, and soon it'll be PARC.
The Colorado State Legislature recently passed House Bill 1202, which requires that we have further science and social science testing. This law was passed with few public hearings and, importantly, no student input. This state, rather than federal law, is called CMAS, and while it passed overwhelmingly in the state legislature, it is far less popular among educators and students.
So what's the problem with the new standardized testing? There are a few issues.
First, we don't think it's a good idea to test students in the fall of their senior year. During this time, we are already bombarded with the ACT, the SAT, the SAT subject tests, and above all, college applications, all which have a direct impact on our future. The CMAS is an unnecessary stressor that distracts from our learning.
Second, the CMAS testing doesn't align with our high school curriculum. For instance, economics plays a major role on the social studies test, even though economics isn't a required course for high school students.
Furthermore, we are tested on all the science and social studies we have taken in high school at one time. For example, we might not have taken biology or geography in several years, but we are expected to know these materials as well as the courses we are currently in.
Additionally, this law was passed with very few public hearings and little input from students or teachers. It is designed by a for-profit company, Pearson, rather than educators, and we are thus doubtful that it is the best way to test our knowledge. During a trial last year with 7th grade students, only 17% of students were deemed proficient.
Even though Amendment 23 to the Colorado Constitution mandates that education funding increase every year, funding for education has actually dropped 6% since 2008 due to a conflicting amendment called TABOR and increased standardized testing.
The $36 million spent on CMAS could have instead been used to improve our education. With this amount of money, we could have paid the salary of about 500 more teachers, bought around 50,000 new textbooks, or have been used to vastly improve our school's infrastructure.
So what are we doing? We've drafted an open letter to our community outlining our grievances regarding standardized testing. Please read it, share it, and sign it.
We're also sending letters to our state legislators, as well as the Colorado Task Force that will be revising Colorado's standardized testing system. On November 13th and 14th, the day CMAS is scheduled, we will not be taking the test, but instead protesting on the ultimate frisbee field outside of the school. We encourage you to come and join us. You can have your parents opt you out of the test by emailing or calling the Fairview office. If your parents do not opt you out, you will receive an unexcused absence. However, the school and the district cannot take any other punitive measures.
We will also be holding a food drive for Community Food Share and a school supplies drive for the Family Learning Center. So bring non-perishable food and extra school supplies to provide others with better quality education.
This isn't just a senior's issue either. Freshmen, sophomores, and juniors, you will have to take these tests in the future if something doesn't change.
That's why we encourage underclassmen to join us on the mornings of November 13th and 14th rather than sleeping in and stand up for your education.
If you have questions, please send an email to us at cmasprotests@gmail.com. Thank you for watching, and we look forward to seeing you at the protests.
So that was what the students themselves have to say in Colorado. And here's what happened with that. Students protested outside Fairview High School in 0 degree temperatures, holding signs that read education, not standardization. They took turns standing outside, collecting non-perishable food items for a food bank. Inside, dozens of students were busy writing letters to state lawmakers expressing why they chose to skip the tests. Thursday morning, only 9 Fairview students took the science test out of 538 seniors. Friday, 10 students took the social studies test out of the same number. So this is a very effective strike in terms of numbers. I guess those are the 9 and 10 students who either don't care about it or whose parents wouldn't allow them to opt out, or their children of administrators. I don't know. Very interesting. That's a really good turnout for something like that. So if people want to call this generation lazy, they should learn a little bit about these students, because that takes a lot of organizing to do that. District officials told students if they opt out with parents' permission, it's considered an excused absence. If they don't show up, it's counted as unexcused. So the state defended the tests. and but the students really are not having it, and that's good. That's the first step of coming up with something else. So let's see what I'm scrolling down to find next steps. Zerkowski with the State Education Department says down the road, local school boards may decide to use the test as a graduation standard to show the student has mastered the subject instead of requiring a certain number of courses. Colleges have indicated that in the future they may use scores to allow students into credit-bearing courses so they won't be required to take remedial classes. Legislation also allows flexibility for when science and social studies tests can be administered in high school assessment. There was an effort to hit the right balance, Zerkowski says. I'm not sure we did, and until we have the conversations afterwards, I don't know how long-term where these two assessments will be. So, there's a more positive example, I think, of these students kind of making their demands. And here's another, my pet high school, Garfield High School in Seattle, are really a historically active high school. Lots of activism activity there over the years. And this is from the end of October. They had a walkout. This is by Lisa Loving on the Scanner newspaper. Last week, hundreds of Garfield supporters thronged outside the Red Brick School in a rainstorm to protest the proposed cut. The dramatic walkout of Garfield High School students and staff last Thursday led out the door by its signature student drumline to protest the late transfer of a core teacher weeks after the year had already started has failed to sway district administrators. The district's announcement on October 17th that because of a drop in projected enrollment, they would be transferring a core teacher at Garfield to an over-enrolled school provoked outrage and headlines around the country. For its part, the district has denied that it issued an ultimatum on the teacher transfer and that several other schools received the same message. The district says that every October they look at enrollment to rebalance teacher assignments so that schools it deems are too crowded receive teachers transfers from schools where the student population has gone down. But basically what happened here in Garfield, I'm going to summarize because it's a long article. What happened in Garfield is that students and teachers alike and parents point to slightly different enrollment numbers than the district pointed to and say that they are actually over-enrolled also. Pretty much every school in the state and in the country, aside from private schools and really well-funded public districts, since we fund things through property taxes, which is kind of inherently unequal, have a pretty rough teacher-to-student ratio. And one thing that just happened this week that I want to talk about before the end of the show is that Washington State passed a class size initiative. I was very confused about this initiative because I'm not sure how it's supposed to work. Let's read this article and maybe we'll all find out together. This is on Politico. It's by Maggie Severns. Is it 2016 yet? Let's see. Where is this? This is an all over 2016 midterm rundown. Here we go. Washington State to curb class size. Washington State has narrowly approved a ballot measure that caps class sizes. The narrow margin, 50.5% to 49.5%, was unexpected given that a statewide poll last month found 66% of voters supported the measure. It caps class sizes at 17 to 25 students, depending on the grade level, with even lower student-teacher ratios required in high-poverty schools. It also requires schools to hire more librarians, nurses, guidance counselors, and teacher's aides. The estimated cost, nearly $3 billion over the next two-year budget. Local school districts will likely have to come up with more than half that funding on their own. Leonie Hameson, executive director of the advocacy group Class Size Matters, said the success of the ballot initiative is terrific news. If the initiative is rolled out properly, Washington kids will shoot to the head of the pack in terms of achievement, graduation rates, and real learning. So that's really interesting. Again, it's a mandate, and Washington has a constitution that isn't unique among the states, but it is different than many that actually has a mandate that public education be the highest priority of the state government itself, and that it be fully funded. It's not something that is being met currently. So really interesting stuff. And suddenly I am fully out of time. There's so much more to talk about with this. I hope to bring some high school students into the studio to talk, maybe team up with the Raise Your Voice crew sometime in the near future. So stay tuned for that. Next week, I'm going to be continuing Education Month in a kind of backwards way, talking about the mass media and the news media, the role that has in continuing our education as adults. So stay tuned for that. Thanks so much for listening. You've been listening to Praxis on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Riverside Avenue in the historic. Let's wait for that to end and pan up to some music instead. That was a poor planning on my part. So FYES is up next. They will be in the studio in just a minute. Thanks for listening.